Why does a new sneaker suddenly become all the rage? How does a book by an obscure novelist land on the bestseller list? These questions have baffled the business world for years, and so far, no one's found the formula for bottling success. But they are trying. Journalist Malcolm Gladwell is one of those who's looking for clues to explain the mysterious moment when a minor trend explodes into a national phenomenon. His book, The Tipping Point, charts a few examples. Take hush puppies, those soft brown shoes that were popular when I was a kid, but had fallen out of fashion.
They were about to be phased out by Wolverine, the company that makes them. That whole line was so unpopular that it was about to die. And then, quite by accident, the people who ran Wolverine found out that the shoes were starting to be worn by kind of hip kids in downtown Manhattan and in L.A. And not only that, then those kids had sort of passed on the hush puppy virus to a bunch of very cutting-edge fashion designers. And if you look in the fashion shows in the like in 95 or 96, there were models walking down the runway in New York and L.A., you know, wearing $5,000 suits and hush puppies, $28 hush puppies. Somehow there was something about them that appealed to a certain set of incredibly socially influential kids. And you can actually date the rise of hush puppies to that moment. And within 6 months, 8 months, the shoes had just exploded and the company couldn't make enough of them. And they, you know, people were buying them in the malls across the country. It's an example of an incredibly rapid transformation. And I think I call it that kind of transformation, epidemic transformation, because that's the only way to understand it. There was something about those shoes that allowed them to spread from one person to another, just like a virus does.
I can imagine Wolverine looking at this saying, I want to know how this happened. Mm-hmm. I don't care about hush puppies this time. That's all done with. They're out there. They're selling. Mm-hmm. How can we make this happen with the next thing? Yeah. Do you have any idea?
Well, in my book, The Tipping Point, I go into this a little bit. Can this kind of process be manipulated and sort of hijacked for commercial purposes? It can be done, but I have two very substantial caveats. One is I have a case study in the book about another shoe company that actually set out to deliberately do this, a skateboarding shoe company called Airwalk,
okay,
which very deliberately and very brilliantly actually takes a shoe that had been used only by sort of hardcore skateboarders in Southern California and turns that shoe into a national phenomenon. They did that by finding those very, very socially influential, cool kids and very methodically figuring out what those kids were interested in culturally and taking all of those cultural ideas and putting them into the advertising for Airwalk.
I think this is a fascinating thing, and I actually mm-hmm. would like you to explain it from the beginning. I saw Airwalks only after they had become a national trend, and I was fascinated to discover that they had been a very tiny, intentionally tiny,
yes,
niche mm-hmm. shoe. Yeah. Airwalks was interested only in the skateboarders when they started.
And not just the skateboarder, the hardcore Southern California skateboarder. And they would sell the shoes only in the kind of what they call surf shops, which are these kind of specialty boutique shops in Southern California that cater to a very specific, dedicated, hardcore surf and skate customer. And then the decision was made, we would like to be a national brand.
So how did they do that?
Well, they operate on the theory that trends start with, you know, cool kids, right? And then they spread to the mainstream. And it takes a little while to spread to the mainstream, 6-8 months, sometimes a year. So if you know what, if you have a very good idea of what very, very cool kids are thinking today, you will have a sense of what the mainstream is going to be thinking or doing or wondering about or interested in 6 or 8 months from now.
Actually, this is very cool for a company because it takes 6 months, 8 months to a year
exactly,
to come out with
a line and do a whole marketing campaign. So they brought in somebody who I talk about in the book, this very brilliant woman called Dee Dee Gordon, who is, I think, the best of the new wave of marketers in this country. And she developed a network of people throughout the United States, actually throughout the world, of kids who then go into the cool clubs and go into the high schools and go into the skateboarding and surf communities and talk to the kind of ringleaders, the kids who seem to have style and panache. And so, for example, at one point they noticed that these cool kids across the country are very interested in kind of campy, futuristic stuff. Like they're really interested in, you know, the Jetsons, that whole. And they asked them, you know, what kind of inventions would you make if you were interested, if you could make one invention? And they come up with, you know, time travel or cars that could fly or this whole kind of, you know, 50s notion of what the future looks like. So that particular motif was taken and was directly placed into the ads for Airwatch sneakers. So 6 to 8 months later, if you look at the Airwalk ads, they're all about, you know, kids flying through the air in some kind of Jetsony outfit and wearing their Airwalks, or just endless variations on this theme. And sure enough, that proved to be an incredibly potent marketing force because, you know, the other kids, the mainstream kids, were just picking up on that. And so they would see these Airwalk ads and they would go, whoa, you know, these guys are, you know, completely tapping into what I think is cool right now.
Actually, this has nothing to do with the quality of the shoes itself, does it,
no.
so far? I mean, we're not talking about, I bought these shoes because they fit, I bought these shoes because they look cool. You're talking about, I bought these shoes because cool people are wearing them.
Yeah, yeah. It's also, and this is where the caveats come in, it's a very tricky business because the cool kid, by definition, is not interested in participating in this process. He or she is not, you know, considers it a corruption of their own personal aesthetic to be involved in some kind of marketing process. And part of, and also what they're interested, they're not interested in starting trends. They're interested in doing these things precisely because no one else is doing them. So there is a point where this process can backfire. And you see that. I mean, Airwalk, the interesting thing about Airwalk is that it rode this epidemic wave and became this incredibly successful shoe company, and then it plunged.
Did they do something that ended their run?
They did do things that were wrong. One of the things they did is, and this is a very important lesson for marketers, is they were basically leveraging the power of these kind of cool kids to make their shoes really popular. And part of the reason that worked is that the cool kids continued to wear Airwalks. The really cutting-edge, hardcore skateboarders, pros, the kids who are really good, Airwalk was still considered to be the shoe of choice for those people. But what happened was, as the Airwalk brand got really, really popular, the company started to neglect these kids. And they didn't give, in the beginning, they had always had a specialty line of shoes for the hardcore skateboarder, and they sold another line for the kind of mass audience.
So if you went to the mall, you were not getting the same shoe that the kid who wore them to skateboard.
Yeah, so the hardcore skateboarder was not walking out one day in his Airwalks and looking around him and seeing kids that he considered to be beneath him wearing the same shoes. He always had a different specialty pair. They stopped doing that. And that was a critical marketing error. And all of a sudden, the kid, the really charismatic, you know, important kid, he wasn't interested in wearing Airwalks anymore because Airwalks were being worn by everybody.
What intrigues me about all of this, and you've examined it in several different ways, is this beginning. Somehow it starts. You talk, for instance, about the novelist Rebecca Wells and the success of her book, The Ya-Ya Sisterhood.
Yeah.
What's fascinating about it is that it didn't start just with that book. It started with another book, and it started just with a couple of booksellers who really liked it.
Yeah.
How is that possible?
Well, it's possible because what happened with the booksellers, Rebecca Wells' first book was essentially sold, 10,000 copies, I've forgotten. It was not a huge success. But it sold very well with a number of incredibly influential independent booksellers, in particular a woman who runs a bookstore in Blytheville, Arkansas. What's important there is that in any kind of social epidemic, there are a handful of people who have an extraordinarily, hugely important role in the beginning. The key person, one of the key people, are people I call mavens. And mavens are the people who have specialized knowledge. They are the sort of person you go to for a recommendation about something. And you can find these people if you sort of look in your social circle. There's someone who you rely on for. But there are also people in sort of broader society who have extraordinary credibility when it comes to matters of taste. And independent bookstores, sellers, independent booksellers have that particular kind of power. So if you can turn on a number of key, powerful independent booksellers to a book, you can start to create a word-of-mouth hit. And that has happened over and over again in this country in the last couple of years. Cold Mountain is a classic example of this.
Charles Frazier's book took off and no one knew anything about that book.
Comes out of, you know, out of nowhere. Interestingly enough, the first John Grisham book was this way. Actually, the second John Grisham book. The first John Grisham book was a disaster. Nobody bought it. The second one was a kind of sleeper hit because a lot of these kind of independent booksellers latched on to Grisham. In fact, the same woman who latched on to Rebecca Wells is also the woman who was very key in the early...
Talk about her for a minute. Why should she be influential? I mean, logic does not suggest that an independent bookseller in Arkansas should have any effect on sales of a book anywhere else in the country, does it?
Well, it does. This woman's name is Mary Gay Shipley. I went down and I met her in Arkansas. She's this incredibly charming woman, and she has got a golden gut for books. She gave me a list of all the books that she has been, that she thought were going to be hits, that turned out to be hits, and the list is as long as my arm. She just knows. She'll read a book in galleys and she'll say, this one is going to make it. And it isn't just that she's predicting what other people will like. It's that she also, she's a taste maker.
What does she do? How does she sell a book?
First of all, everyone who goes to a bookstore, she knows her customer base very, very well. So she knows the kinds of books you will like. And she's been in this business long enough that everybody who goes there, when you go to her bookstore, which is a charming little bookstore in the middle of Arkansas, you go to Mary Gay and you say, you ask Mary Gay what she's reading right now, what she's into. It's just one of those places where she has that kind of personality. She's incredibly approachable. She's incredibly persuasive. And she's got impeccable taste.
One of the things I liked about your description is that the bookstore is, as you said, a little bookstore. Mm-hmm. It is not a bookstore where you are going to see everything that is available in print this year.
It's a tiny bookstore. You can browse her fiction section in 15 minutes. Every book in there is in there, in that store, because she's read it and she likes it. And so you can see, I mean, I got a sense of how powerful something like that can be, because she would say things like, you know, a lot of my customers are people who don't live here anymore. They come here to visit their parents, or they come and they drive over here and then they go back to where they're from. So you can see automatically then that people are coming to Arkansas from all over the country, finding out what Mary Gay's into, and then flying back to Seattle or Washington or Boston or New York or wherever they're from and taking the word with them.
And I suppose by this time there must be booksellers who come from Seattle and Boston and New York.
Oh, sure. And she's got a newsletter and sends it out. I mean, in the modern age, we're so obsessed with kind of formal means of communication. We think that the only way to get the message out is to buy an ad in a magazine or run a commercial on television. No, the most important way of communicating is still word of mouth. And the amazing thing about word of mouth, if you look at it closely, is that word of mouth is something that is, as I said, is controlled and generated by a tiny, tiny fraction of people. And one person who's incredibly well-connected can have an extraordinary power in spreading the word about something.
Malcolm Gladwell is a staff writer for The New Yorker and the author of The Tipping Point.